For the week of June 10th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 151, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
So I assume that you went to the Tony Awards last night.
I never go to the Tony Awards. They never ask. It's a lot more fun to watch things like that on TV. If you're a journalist, you have to sit backstage. It's no fun. You don't get a seat in the auditorium. And that's where all the fun is. So I watched it on television and enjoyed it. Well, not really, but watched it on television just like everybody else.
I like your, we'll talk about the Tonys. As a matter of fact, before we begin today's show, we should probably point out a little programming note. We will be off the next 2 weeks.
So blame Sperling.
Yes, you can blame me. Or, you can thank me because we'll give you an extra dose of Showbiz Sandbox this week. We'll give you maybe a little bit longer.
As if it's never long enough.
That's true. Right. But, you know, we were talking about the Tony Awards just a few seconds ago. And on today's show, that's exactly what we're going to be covering, the Tony Awards. We'll tell you who won all the big awards, what the upsets were, and, of course, how well Neil Patrick Harris did as host. And probably more importantly than how Neil Patrick did as host is how good Michael was in all of his predictions from last week.
I don't remember making predictions, but
but that's funny because I've actually got them written down right here.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes. I wrote them down as I was editing last week's show. We're also going to be talking a lot about music on today's show, and I am incredibly excited that we have Bob Boylan from NPR Music and the All Songs Considered podcast. He will be joining us a little later on to tell us why he just deleted his entire music collection and why that's actually a good thing, or at least could be. The publishing industry sales charts get upended, we'll explain, or at least Michael will. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll end with some inside baseball where we'll discuss why there may be no such thing as a sold-out show, or how Justin Bieber, my new neighbor, by the way, sold out Madison Square Garden in just 30 seconds. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is the animated film Madagascar 3, the third in a franchise that nobody loves, but everybody goes to see. It grossed $136 million worldwide in its debut. At number two is Prometheus, the Ridley Scott film, which opened in North America after opening overseas in some key territories. It grossed $89 million worldwide. It's at $141 million and counting. In North America, those two movies both debuted to over $50 million, which is a rare occurrence when two movies open on a weekend and both of them gross more than $50 million. Usually, movies that are going to gross that big avoid the weekend when another one is there, but Prometheus is R-rated. Madagascar is a family-oriented animated film, so they're a good fit together. They're not stealing each other's audience, and they were both successes in North America. Madagascar grossed $60 million and Prometheus just at $50 million. We haven't gotten final figures yet, but for the moment, it looks like we have two movies debuting in North America at plus $50 million. So that is very good news for the box office.
Well, now, and we should say that we're giving you the worldwide box office grosses, but you just kind of took a little bit of a sidetrack just to kind of talk about North American box office for just a moment there.
That's right, because they were the big new releases and they had made, it's very, very rare that two movies debut at plus $50 million in North America, so it was worth pointing out. But as always, we gather worldwide box office. We're one of the few places to do it because we care. We think worldwide box office matters more. That's what matters in the final tally of whether a movie is a success. Look at Men in Black 3. That grossed $52 million worldwide. It's at $487 million and counting. In North America, it's the number four film. It's sort of dropping hard and fast. You know, it's done okay, but it hasn't been a huge hit. It's made $135 million. But overseas, it's already the top grossing film in that franchise. It is, you know, the number one film. It's grossed more than Men in Black 1 or 2. Will Smith is a huge draw overseas. It's not done yet. It's still making money. And it's only $100 million from its worldwide total. So a movie that has sort of faded from memory a little bit in the U.S., overshadowed by new releases. If you pay attention to worldwide box office, you realize Men in Black 3 is a big success story as far as that franchise. Now, it costs a lot of money to make. It costs maybe $200 million, another $100 million to promote. So it really needs to make $600 million at least in order to break even.
And it will never do that.
Well, it's at $500 million practically right now.
Oh, so, yeah, that's true. I'm sorry. Yeah, that, I forgot that.
It very well could hit $600 million worldwide. Well, we'll have to look at the numbers. I'm not certain, but it should, you know, blow past $600 million. Not blow past, but it should make $600 million worldwide. I'm not sure what territories it hasn't opened up in yet. Maybe Japan is still looking in its future. I'm not sure. That's a little hard to track. But, you know, and this is June. And in June, football or soccer, as we call it, is really dominant in Europe, and that really depresses the box office. So it could fall hard and fast. But right now, it's already the biggest overseas grosser in the franchise, in the Men in Black franchise. It's at just under $500 million worldwide. It's just $100 million away from probably breaking even. So that's good news for Men in Black 3. And number four around the world is Snow White and the Huntsman, which grossed $47 million. It's at $182 million and counting. That's probably roughly what the movie costs to make.
But, you know, this, in my opinion, at least in North America, it really does prove how important it is to pick an opening weekend. And I know in the summer it's really, really hard. But Snow White and the Huntsman here in North America dropped 60%. And the reason it dropped 60% is everybody went to see Prometheus.
So and it's not that good.
And, well, yeah. And, by the way, it got really bad word of mouth. But you can see, like, if you think you're going to have a big opening weekend and you might be able to push it into a second weekend, then you don't want any huge movie opening during your second weekend and stepping all over you. So there are films that will say, you know what, yes, we have that weekend all to ourselves, but unfortunately, the weekend after that, we're going to get crushed. So we're going to actually move ourselves up a weekend and maybe go against some weaker competition up front so that we don't get stepped on in the back end.
Well, release dates are very important, but it's very hard to find 2 weekends in a row that are soft.
That's
where your
true.
Movie can open.
That
you know, if
true.
It had opened in February or March, it would have gotten steamrolled by The Hunger Games. You know, there is just no safe date anymore. But, you know, whether it would have been better off earlier, it may not have opened that big if it had opened in February. But, you know, they did open it, so that's a certain success. The movie itself probably didn't deliver, and therefore that means you're not going to make legs no matter where when you open or where. And number five around the world is The Avengers, which grossed another $18 million worldwide. It's just a tad under $1.4 billion. It's at $1.396 billion worldwide. It's the number three film of all time. It hasn't opened yet in Japan. It'll probably pull in $100 million, if not more, in Japan alone. So this is going to probably tap out at about $1.5 billion. It's not going to get close to the $2 billion of Avatar and Titanic, but it will be the third highest grossing film worldwide of all time. So that's a big success story. Less of a success story is Sacha Baron Cohen's comedy, The Dictator. That grossed $7 million worldwide. It's at $125 million and counting. Also a disappointment, Johnny Depp's Dark Shadows, $6 million worldwide, just over $200 million and counting.
I cannot believe that movie has made $200 million worldwide.
Well, Johnny Depp's a huge star, you know? It's a broad film with Johnny Depp and Tim Burton. I would be shocked if it didn't make $200 million. You know, he's just going to do that in that type of film, even if it doesn't deliver, at least for, you know, the next five films.
Right.
And number eight is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. That seems to have grossed $5 million worldwide. Sometimes with smaller films, it gets harder for us to track the numbers. But we think it's grossed $5 million, and it is at $113 million worldwide and counting. And number nine is Battleship, which grossed another $3 million worldwide. It's just under $300 million total and counting. And number 10 is What to Expect When You're Expecting. That's in North America only. It grossed $2.7 million. And is at $35 million and counting. And number 11, a specialty release, Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson film. Bill Murray had a very funny appearance on David Letterman promoting the movie. If you have YouTube, check it out. Bill Murray Letterman, Moonrise Kingdom, and you can watch his whole routine. It grossed $1.5 million on just 95 screens. So that's a very good per screen average. It just edged out a French film, Rust and Bone, which grossed $1.4 million in France. And Moonrise Kingdom is at $3.7 million and counting. It's still got a ways to go to expand to see how it will do with a wide audience. But as a specialty release, it's doing quite well.
Well, and you mentioned that, you know, if Snow White and the Huntsman had opened up in February or March, it would have been stepped on by The Hunger Games. And that film is at, you know, what it's in its 12th week right now. It came in number 12 at the North American box office, making over $1 million. And it is now the 14th film to reach over the $400 million mark domestically.
Oh, The Hunger Games. I wasn't sure what film you were talking about.
Yeah, The Hunger Games.
Yes, The Hunger Games. It grossed $1 million this week, and it's $400 million in North America. It just made it by the, you know, hair of its chinny chin chin.
Now, that's a franchise, and, you know, looks like there's a couple of franchises in our top, well, it looks like a top 11 this week worldwide. I mean, look at The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. I cannot wait for the mediocre exotic Marigold Hotel and the so-so.
The second best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, people go to Mexico.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
People in North America cross the border into Mexico for better health care and lower cost of living. So you could have, you'd want to avoid those towns where there's gunfire. But, you know, that could be a spinoff of the franchise of old people moving into new countries in order to live cheaply. Certainly Madagascar is a franchise. Prometheus, we know that Fox wants to make another one in that. They think maybe that can re-energize the Alien franchise if that's what it is.
So it would be a prequel sequel.
That's right, a prequel sequel. Yeah. I don't know if the numbers ultimately are going to be good enough to warrant that or whether they'll want to creatively, but that's certainly a possibility. Men in Black 3, if it keeps going, they may have an argument for Men in Black 4. And obviously, the Avengers is the big one. That's the real franchise in what we're talking about here.
You know, I saw Madagascar 3 in Cannes, and halfway through, you know, it was in 3D. Halfway through, my contact lens popped out, and I could not find it at all. And I'm sitting in the middle of the row, you know, and you know Cannes. You cannot get up and just leave when you're sitting in the middle of a row. There's 20 people to your left, 20 people to your right. I could not find my contact lens. I had to sit there for half the movie with, you know, watching it with one eye.
That must have been torture.
It was torture. I basically just wanted to close my eyes and go to sleep. But there was a point in the film where Alex the lion is talking to the circus animals and telling them why their circus act is no longer popular. And he said, you know, it's just that you're going through the motions. It's not special anymore. And I just thought, really? You'd put that line of dialogue into the third installment of a franchise? Interesting.
I didn't see the film because there are no children in my life. I haven't seen any of those three films. But I've heard mixed things about Prometheus. One friend thought it was quite good, though he wasn't happy with the ending. And I think he was overpraising it. Another friend hated it and didn't even think it was good looking, or even worth bothering with. Neither of them thinks the 3D is essential.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I don't know. Was it shot in 3D or was it?
It was designed to be shown in 3D, certainly.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think any movie down the road will be, oh my gosh, we should convert it to 3D and we weren't expecting to. We did have that with G.I. Joe Retribution, but I think that's going to be, anybody now can say, oh no, we plan to make it 3D all along, because they almost all know in advance that's what they're going to do. It doesn't mean they put a lot of effort into it or think a lot about how to shoot it or make it dramatically different, but they all, I think, from the get-go know, oh, yeah, we're going to do it in 3D. But I think Prometheus, they very much felt the 3D was a big draw. I mean, it was like a 70% of ticket sales in Europe were in 3D for that opening weekend, at least in the UK. I don't know what the numbers are in North America. Obviously, it opened well, so I'm sure a good chunk of them were 3D.
Well, which one of the top box office earners from this week worldwide do you think will be turned into a Broadway musical? I'm going to go with Men in Black 3.
You're joking, but I would say the best exotic Marigold Hotel has probably the best chance. I haven't seen Moonrise Kingdom. I know music always plays a role in his films. I don't know if that would be the one to get turned into a musical. I would guess Rushmore would probably be more likely, or Royal Tenenbaums. But not joking, I would say perhaps best exotic Marigold Hotel would appeal to the older Broadway audience. I know Room with a View has been turned into a musical. I had that idea for years. I wanted to write Room with a View as a musical. And that's touring, I think, in California or some other cities. It hasn't made it to Broadway yet. Whether it will, I don't know.
But I cannot believe you took my segue joke and turned it into a serious comment.
Sorry about that.
Well, I mean, okay.
I don't joke when it comes to theater.
Well, that's, and guess what? Yesterday night was Broadway's big night, the Tony Awards on Broadway at some theater. Where was it? At the Beacon?
It's at the Beacon Theater because yeah. The Radio City Music Hall is taken up by the Cirque du Soleil extravaganza Zarkana, which is not worth seeing, trust me.
Well, what did you think? It was the big night last night, and you take it all seriously, and a lot of us are saying, Ghost, I saw that movie back in the 80s.
Well, you know, there's three things to discuss. One, which shows will benefit commercially from the show and from their award wins? How was the show as a television show itself? And how did I do in my predictions? Let's start with my predictions. I don't even know.
I can answer number two, which is boring. And number three, I haven't really looked yet. I was going to do it when we went down the...
Okay. Well, we're not going to go through every category.
No, not every category. No. But where do you want to start?
Let's start with the show.
Okay. Well, the boring part. Go ahead.
Oh, I don't think it's boring. As a television show, I thought it was poorly done.
Yeah.
First of all, it's a weak year for musicals. So a lot of the performances were retreads from previous years or poor excuses for a musical performance on the Tony Awards. The show opened with the Book of Mormon, which, you know, hey, it's the hottest show on Broadway, but it felt a little, you know, been there, done that.
Yeah, so why do they do that?
Well, they didn't have enough. I mean, they only had two shows nominated for Best Score, Newsies and the already closed Bonnie and Clyde. There just were not a lot of hot new musicals on board. You know, there were some revivals, but Follies is already closed. Leap of Faith is already closed. You know, there just weren't a lot of shows on Broadway that are fresh that had, needed the Tonys to boost them. So they need to fill up the show. It is the hottest show on Broadway. But the other problem with the opener, I thought, was that you had a celebrity sort of slamming the door in the face of, you know, Book of Mormon people trying to witness, which is like, of course, that's what people do when you knock on their door. You say, I don't want to talk to you. But it just felt a little like, gee, people already think Broadway hates religion. It just felt not the greatest positive way to start the show. You had other, you know, ridiculous performances. The worst of all was Hairspray. They towards
Why
the end
did
of the
they
show,
do that? Do they realize that Hairspray is like 10 years old at this point?
Yeah. Well, they'd run out of shows. So they had Godspell, which has been on the boards for a while, did not get a nomination for Best Revival, but has a new star, Corbin Bleu from Degrassi. And he came on the show and they did a montage. Then they had Hairspray on a cruise ship.
That was the weirdest thing. I could not figure out for the life of me why they did that. And then I realized, oh, it was a big commercial for Royal Caribbean or Princess.
Well, that's what it felt like. Obviously, Broadway says, hey, here's a new revenue stream. If we can get these cruise ships. Cruise ships have always put on shows. I've had friends who have worked on cruise ships. You commit to 6 months or a year, you tour and go, you know, to the Caribbean or, you know, overseas or whatever, and you put on original shows is what they do. Now, obviously, the cruise lines are saying a bigger draw is to create a space, and the space on television looked pretty impressive, and put on a full-scale Broadway show with top-notch talent, you know, just like you might see if you were in Oklahoma or Chicago or something, the show was touring. And, you know, it was a professional production. It looked like a very nice venue that they had built on that ship. That's a lot of space to devote to a stage production in a cruise ship where space is at such a premium. So
yeah, well, obviously I can tell you on a cruise ship, they usually have theaters that are about, they can be upwards of between 1,000 and 2,000 seats.
Right. So, but this looked like a lovely space. And clearly they're saying, hey, Broadway wants to say, hey, we want all the cruise ships to do this and bring in our shows rather than mount their own productions. It's another revenue stream for us. They clearly wanted to promote that idea. And hence we had a performance of this 10-year-old show on a cruise ship, which was kind of shocking. And then they had to climax with Leap of Faith, the show that is already closed. So performance wise,
I just don't get who mic'd the people for Hairspray. It's like they had no concept that they were on television and mics dangling on their forehead, which is, by the way, how you get mic'd on Broadway, because nobody sees it in the last row. But on television?
Well, there's no other way to do it. I mean, if you sit in the first 10 rows or 15 rows on Broadway, you see the mics all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
If you want them to be heard, you have to have the mics there. And some of the better mics can be placed a little more discreetly. But I would imagine they don't have the most expensive microphone system on a cruise ship, you know, or touring. So I imagine its cost is another reason. I'm sure they did the best job they could. It's just something that you just get used to seeing. It looks like they all have dindi dots, you know, they're all Hindu or something.
Yeah.
But that's just what happens. But yeah, performance-wise, I thought it was poor. A lot of the shows tried to do a montage or medley of two or three or four numbers. I think it's a huge mistake. Show after show, you know, tried to squeeze in three songs, four songs into their performance, where when you pick one song, you do it really well. That's what really sells a show. It always works better than trying to, you know, do a greatest hits from all your numbers. You know, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Ghost was cacophonous. Porgy and Bess did four songs, I think. It was just, you know, ridiculous. When a show focused on one number, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, and especially Once, all focused on one number and did it well. Newsies did as well. Once, I thought, was the performance of the night. But overall, I thought the performances were kind of a mess.
Yeah. Well, the Jesus Christ Superstar performance did come off incredibly well. And that's because, of course, it was the Tony-nominated Josh Young.
Yeah, and he had just lost Best Supporting Actor in a Musical, so he had something to prove. He had to come on stage and, you know, sell his number after losing.
Yeah, pretty much.
To one of the actors from Nice Work If You Can Get It. So, you know, he wanted to show it. Hey, baby, I got it. So, you know, when you can't get Jeremy Jordan, think about me. That's what he was telling Broadway producers. And I've always wanted an electric blue suit like he had, but I thought he did a good job as well. But once I thought was the emotional highlight of the show. It was simple. It was direct. But overall, the direction of those numbers was also poor. I thought they did a very poor job of capturing the dance and the choreography. I just thought it was the opening number with Neil Patrick Harris was sort of sloppy. There were a number of mistakes and flubs. He got better as the show went on. But I thought as a show, I thought if you didn't know these Broadway shows, they sounded like a mess. Ghost was a train wreck.
Yeah,
so many of the shows were closed. So many of the shows were old shows that they were bringing back or shows that hadn't even been nominated that it felt like a very, and then the cruise ship, it just felt like a show that was pretty routine and not very well done.
Well, and Follies, I mean, it really just went to prove that there are Stephen Sondheim fans and then there are those that don't like Stephen Sondheim because that was not, I mean, I was watching this going, why did they pick this song?
Well, they picked that song because the actor was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a Musical. The show had closed. Okay. It's in L.A., or I think it just closed in L.A., perhaps.
Yes.
But that guy was nominated. So, you know, he's nominated. You let him do his big number. But out of context of the show, that frantic number doesn't work.
No.
So it wasn't his fault. It's not even my favorite number in the show. Manny Patinkin does it brilliantly. This guy did it well. But on the show, when you haven't been following, you know, sometimes people come to a big number in a show and they're sort of over the top because you haven't watched the rest of the show and build up to that moment. You have to build up to that moment. So when you don't build up to it, it doesn't work. And that's exactly what happened there.
Well, you know, one moment in the show really caught my attention and or really made me think. And that was, you know, by the time the Nice Work If You Can Get It bit came on.
Medley.
Yeah. I didn't want to.
Yes, first you had Kelly O'Hara.
Wait. That was the point. That was my whole story, was that I wasn't even paying attention, to be honest. I was, you know, I was already doing the working on the show notes for today's show and kind of not really paying attention. And so they introduce some show. I don't even know which one it is. All of a sudden, this voice comes over through my head and I look up and there's this person on stage dressed as what looks like a newsboy. I'm thinking, is this Newsies again? This can't be Newsies again. And I'm like, is that a guy? I think that's a girl. The person has a phenomenal voice and is absolutely drop dead gorgeous. And I'm like, who the heck is that? And so at the end of her little bit there, she was singing Someone to Watch Over Me. The person comes out and says the character's name, Billy. So I look it up. It's Kelly O'Hara, South Pacific. I mean, she's like a Broadway darling. And if I said, you know, it just goes to show you that when you've got it, you've really got it.
Well, I thought you were going to say the point for that piece for me was that she was brandishing a shotgun, which was very funny in the show when you see the musical Nice Work If You Can Get It, which I don't recommend. But anyway, she's a charming performer. And it's very funny in the show when she's brandishing the shotgun while singing this romantic ballad. On stage, out of context, it just didn't work. You're kind of like, why is she holding a rifle? Shotgun? It just didn't make sense. And then, of course, it was a medley. So instead of hearing her sing that whole song and do it lovely, you segue to part of it. And then you go to Matthew Broderick dancing around and none of it worked.
Well, what worked for me was not knowing anything and just kind of like catching something out of the corner of my eye and the corner of my ear. I mean, you really can understand why Kelly O'Hara and others like her are well respected and why and what makes them stars.
Oh, yeah. She's got a great voice. So that was the show as a show. I thought it was sort of a mess. I thought Neil Patrick Harris did a good job, as always. The opener was rough, but his second and third musical moments, including the closer, were good. And I thought he did a fine job. But
I liked the bit as Spider-Man when he was like dangling over Angela Lansbury and couldn't get off. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that was funny. So as a show, I thought it was pretty boring. I thought most of the performances came off poorly. So that didn't help them. What did help the shows was that Once had a great performance. I think Newsies had a good performance for what it is. And I think commercially, you're going to see Once, which has been building into a Broadway hit. It's been, you know, it's a strong hit now, but I think this is going to put it over the top, obviously. It helps a lot. You know, it's in the $800,000 range and selling out most of its tickets, and it's been slowly increasing how much it charges for those tickets. So I think word of mouth has been great, and it's been building, and now this will put it over the top and will make it very commercial and be able to tour with this show, and I think that's obviously the biggest boost. Once gets a big boost. Porgy and Bess, which for some reason has been floundering commercially, won Best Revival. That's the biggest upset of one of the biggest upsets of the night, I think.
Well, everybody, do you want to go through your list of who you had picked?
Sure. Well, I'm just saying, just finishing commercially, who's going to benefit? I think Porgy and Bess desperately needed to win. It's still on the boards. It's not doing great. I don't know why. It's a great show with a lot of great songs that you already know. And winning Best Revival, that was probably the biggest upset of the night. And Best Actress for Audra McDonald, you know, she's one of the most awarded actors in Broadway history. So that's terrific. That really was a much needed boost. Once or Newsies, both of them were doing well. So either one of them could have won the Tony for Best Musical, and I think they both would have been fine. Porgy and Bess really needed that, and it's still on board. So that's probably why it pulled it off. Follies has closed, and Porgy and Bess needed the help. So there you go. And then the other big winner is Clybourne Park, which won the Tony for Best Broadway Play. It won the Pulitzer, so it's hardly a shock. It's a terrific show, but it hasn't exactly been packing them in. It's doing well, and of course, it's a play, so its running costs are lower than a musical. It's been grossing about $400,000 a week, about three quarters full. It deserves the attention. It deserves the win. I thought it was the best new play on Broadway, and hopefully, that will get more people in to see it.
Well, okay, so let's go through some of your selections and who won. Now, you just mentioned Clybourne Park. You did say, hey, that's going to win Best Play.
Did I on the show? Because, I mean, I Peter and the Starcatcher was my last minute. I was looking for an upset from Peter and the Starcatcher. That won the most awards.
You did say that, you know, it could be an upset from Peter and the Starcatcher. You did mention that.
But I did stick with Clybourne Park. Good for me. All right. So, and I got Best Musical right once, obviously.
That's right. Now, Best Revival of a Play I put down as Newsies, but I think I was
No, that was Death of a Salesman. I knew that. Yeah. I did get Best Revival of a Musical wrong. I thought that was going to be Follies. I bought into what everybody said.
And it was Porgy and Bess.
That's right. So that was a terrific upset. That was probably the biggest shock of the night.
Now, and then Best Actor in a Play, you said Philip Seymour Hoffman from Death of a Salesman, and it wasn't.
No, it was James Corden from Corden or Condon? Corden, I think. Yeah, James Corden, who looks like Philip Seymour Hoffman and says Philip Seymour Hoffman is one of his favorite actors, literally his favorite actor of all time. Probably because they both look similar. They're both sort of heavyset guys. And he probably thought, hey, if Philip Seymour Hoffman can make it, I can make it. But that was, I didn't feel like his show, One Man, Two Governors, had sort of won over the Broadway community as much as it had in London, where it was an absolute sensation. It's doing well, it's playing. And it's a comic role, but, you know, that was a bit of a surprise. Not a shocker.
Was it as much of a surprise as Best Actor in a Musical? You said Jeremy Jordan, this new sensation on Broadway, they were going to crown him yesterday. And they kind of did by, you know, when they announced Newsies and their performance by Newsies, they said, you know, Jeremy Jordan and the cast of Newsies.
Well, he's the star of the show, and he's been on two shows on Broadway, originated two roles. He did Bonnie and Clyde and then Newsies. It was between him and Steve Casey. I'm thrilled that Steve Casey won. He was the actor in Once. He's terrific. I would have voted for him. I'm thrilled that he won. And he was one of many people who had lost a family member or someone had given birth. Everybody had emotional stories to tell. His mother died on Easter Sunday as they were, you know, launching into the show on Broadway. And he paid a lovely tribute to his fellow cast members as they helped him emotionally get through this, you know, difficult time. It's hard to go on stage and perform when you're dealing with a loss like that. And the show is a very emotional show. So keeping it in has got to be difficult. And I thought he was very graceful and gracious in his acceptance speech.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the best speeches of the evening, as was James Corden's, I thought was pretty funny.
Yes, his was sweet. He seemed genuinely shocked and, you know, and moved. I thought Judith Light was...
She won for Other Desert Cities, which was one Best Supporting Actress in a Play. That was not one you picked.
Did we announce those?
Yes.
I didn't get it right is what you mean.
Yes.
Oh, who did I pick?
Oh, my notes say Judy Kaye, I want to say.
Oh, right. No, that's a musical. You're confusing play and musical.
Well, that's not the first time. Maybe it was Celia Keenan-Bolger?
I might have picked Peter and the Starcatcher to win both of those. Peter and the Starcatcher won Best Supporting Actor, Christian Borley, and I think I picked Celia to win Best Supporting Actress.
Yes.
The women were very tough this year. A lot of great performances. Judith Light was nominated last year for Lombardi, but this is a real affirmation for her. this is a woman who starred on television, Who's the Boss, and a soap opera. So getting this sort of affirmation and critical acclaim at this stage in her career is just wonderful. And I know I didn't buy her shock and awe when she won. I felt it was
especially when she gets up there and then very quickly, almost as if rehearsed, mentions everyone on Earth.
Yes, yes. But, you know, good for her. I thought she was good in the show.
And you got Best Actress in a Play, correct? Venus in Fur, Nina Arianda won for Best Actress in a Play.
Yes, she that was probably a close role as well, but, you know, a close call. But she was the sensation of the year, got tons of press and critical acclaim. Everybody who saw the show was wowed by her. So, you know, it's the crowning of a new star.
You got Best Director, right, for a play. Of course, Mike Nichols, that wasn't too hard to call.
No, and that was another graceful speech. He talked about having been on the stage of the Beacon Theater before by winning a pie-eating contest back when the Beacon was a movie house. So that was kind of a...
That's
and I
funny.
Thought he really was... He was genuinely moved. He's won 7 Tonys, and yet he was very much moved by it, and they finally played him off.
Yes.
Because he wouldn't stop talking.
I thought it was fine. I was like, you're going to play off Mike Nichols? Really? You're going to play...
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it was 3-hour-long show, and they went over, and they had 14 performances, 14 live awards. It took them forever. The one nice thing I liked about the show was that the tech awards were given off camera, which, of course, at the Oscars, they say, the heck you're going to give the tech awards off camera? We want to be on television. But here for the Tonys, they gave them off camera, but when they introed or came out of commercials or went into commercials, they announced the winners who were given before the broadcast began and gave them a highlight quote from their speech, which I thought is a nice compromise. It gives them their moment in the sun. It presents their best quote,
to hear. Some of those quotes in those speeches were hilarious.
Well, and they weren't speeches. They were literally like a line or two. But yes, it was. I thought it worked quite well. I think if the Oscars could do that, they would. They're not allowed to by the unions. You know, the cinematographers and the editors are like, no, we're not taking us off the air. But, you know, when you're talking about best live action short film, best documentary short, you know what? You might try this.
You were also right for best director of a musical for Once.
Right. Once. I would have picked Once and Peter and the Starcatcher in a lot of the tech awards because those seem like the stone cold favorites. Obviously, Newsies won best score and best choreography, which I believe I predicted properly because it had the most choreography and was practically the only new score that was nominated. Its only real competition was a show that had already closed, Bonnie and Clyde, which didn't even get very good reviews. Another reason why the performances were not great this year, because there weren't a lot of new shows to draw upon.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't think I did too bad.
No, not too bad.
The biggest shock of the Tony Awards for me, if anything, was the performance of The Book of Mormon, because the guys came on the stage, and then the curly mop-haired guy, who's the wacky guy, who was played by Josh Gad in the original Broadway production, came on stage, and the audience burst into applause, and I said, that's not Josh Gad. And it wasn't. It's his replacement. Both he and Andrew Rennell are out of the show. They've left the show just in the last day or two. Andrew Rennell's last day was yesterday. Josh Gad was about 5 days ago. In January, they made a big splash about signing these guys through February of 2013. They signed up for another year of the show. It was a big news. They announced it all over the place. That the
we
two
announced
stars,
it on this show.
It was all over the news. It was official. It wasn't, they had announced it, that they were staying through 2013. It was kind of a surprise because they both had obviously major TV offers and perhaps movie offers and stuff like that. They both were hot commodities. But, you know, you rarely get a show like this. And I thought, hey, good for them. That's smart. You know what? I mean, this is a once in a lifetime time. Enjoy it. Soak it up, baby. And turns out, no, they've 5 months later, they're out of the show. I don't know why. I couldn't find any explanation. Obviously, Josh Gad had his sitcom picked up. Maybe they had outs where, like, if a property or a project that they were ready to commit to, like a TV series, if that got picked up and made the pilot season, maybe they had that out where they could say, okay, if my show gets picked up and I get put on the network schedule, I'm leaving. That's probably what happened with Josh Gad.
There are clauses such as that, yes.
Well, but there wouldn't have been. Yeah. There wouldn't have been for their first year run.
No.
Someone could make up a clause, yes. But right. But I'm saying maybe that's why they're both gone in June.
Right. Precisely.
So that was a little surprise. I'm sorry to say, because I have friends who are coming this summer and they were really looking forward to seeing the original cast. Hope these other guys are great. They looked a little tin type, like they said, all right, we want a Josh Gad. We want exactly that same kind of guy. But I'm sure they're good, and I hope they're good, and we'll find out soon enough.
Well, I don't know if you're going to be downloading any Broadway musicals via MP3 or AAC or iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Do you do that, Michael? You probably get all the scores anyway.
I usually still get physical copies of CDs of stuff, but I do get digital copies. In fact, I've encouraged other people to get digital copies. The Book of Mormon was available for like $1 one week Amazon or somebody else. And I encouraged my brother to buy it, which he did. And now he's coming to come this summer with his son to see the Book of Mormon. So that worked. They, you know, made ticket sales from offering the cast album inexpensively. But I'll tell you what I don't do. I don't store all my music in the cloud. I've got them all on my laptop and my iPhone and stored on my hard drive.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because digital sales are outpacing traditional physical media sales, CDs and vinyl, in at least in the UK for the first quarter. And now, I mean, I have about 15,000 digital songs or digital tracks on my hard drive. And I know you have, you know, I can't even imagine how many you have, Michael. But I do know somebody who might have more than both of us combined, and that is Bob Boylan of NPR. He is the creator and host of All Songs Considered, which, if you have never listened to this podcast, it is probably the best podcast going, along with This Week in Tech. You've got to download it. Trust me, you will thank me later. He is going into the cloud by switching all of his main sources of music to the iTunes iCloud-based service. In a post headlined, "I Just Deleted All My Music," Boylan discussed what he's doing and why. It's the most popular story on NPR's website right now and has hundreds of angry, confused, and encouraging comments. So we're glad, Bob, that you could take the time to talk with us about your decision.
That's great. I've had a number of people come up to me and says, "I'm really so sorry about what happened."
Do they think that somehow your hard drive crashed? Right.
Yeah. It tells you how many people actually read past the headline, but they just thought I lost all my music.
Well, now, you know, since iCloud launched, which was about a year ago, I guess we should explain what iCloud and iTunes Match does. It allows you to upload your songs into the cloud, correct?
Yeah, even better than that. If iTunes already has your song, you don't have to upload it, which is the failing of some of the other digital services, which meant for someone like me who had, you know, 35,000 songs, that's a lot of uploading, a lot of weight. So all iTunes does is kind of scan your library and say, oh, I don't have these 2,000. I have all the others. In fact, I have all the others better than you have them, probably at a better, higher bit rate. So that's what it matches. Matches really is the operative word there.
Well, like me, you've probably been turning your CDs and downloading music since, you know, 1999 or 2000. So a lot of the tracks may be in, you know, when I first started, it was 128 kilobit bit per second, which is not the best audio quality. And now, of course, as you mentioned, iTunes is twice that.
Right. And, you know, and even when I had the choice of 256, I did 128. It's just a size issue. I mean, my 30 gig iPod or whatever it might have been was never going to contain my entire library.
So let's just explain what Bob did. Sperling was a little confused before the show began. The headline said, "I just deleted all my music." And people freaked out and thought that he copied his music up, you know, to the iTunes Match and then got rid of all his backup hard drive music and had no backup anywhere. What he did was he freed up the space on his laptop. He was physically carrying around all his music on his laptop. And of course, he backed it up on an external hard drive like all of us do. And what he's done here is saying, okay, I'm going to access all my music via the cloud, via the iTunes cloud. And that means I don't have to physically have the digital files on my laptop or my phone or my iPad or whatever music device I'm going to use. It doesn't mean that he got rid of his backup hard drive. He still has all his music that he's ever owned backed up on that external hard drive. It's still there in case something goes wrong with the cloud or he wants to go to another service or whatever happens. So what he's done is he's freed up the space on his laptop. And so he's saying, when I'm in Oklahoma and I've got an internet connection, if I decide I want to hear one of my 20,000 tracks, I don't have to have decided to put it on my laptop or remember to put it on my phone. I can start streaming it immediately and hear any song that I own anytime, anywhere.
Exactly. And I love it. It's really cool. No. I mean, it's not without its issues. And I don't know if you want to go down that road now or later, but you were going to ask me something.
Well, yeah, no. What are some of the issues?
Well, I mean, the cloud is a cloud. And so when you have something literally on that iPod or on your iPhone and you hit play, it's responsive as you would imagine and want it to be. Well, it's not always as responsive. It could be a couple of second delay between the touch of the play button and the actual hearing on my computer with a high-speed connection, maybe a second. And then sometimes on the iPhone, if I'm driving, for example, let's say I'm at a light while I'm driving, and I want to change the song, the iPhone can be even less responsive and sometimes frustratingly so. So it depends on the connectivity.
So now you can listen to this over 3G. You can kind of, you know,
absolutely.
Not, okay, I didn't know that. I thought
I drive
only
home every day. Like, there's a whole nother bunch of issues we could get into too, which is what kind of bandwidth are you eating up.
So do you? So that's one big question I have. So do you? If you're traveling, you're going to be on a plane, you're going to be in a car, and you won't necessarily have a great connection all the time. Do you decide to put stuff, some things on your phone in advance, or do you just trust the cloud?
If I know I'm going to be away from the net, I definitely put the night before. I mean, look, it has all of your playlists. So if you use iTunes, all your playlists are literally on all of your devices still. And it will call and you go to a playlist and say, I want to listen to that song. Let's say you're going to take a plane ride that's 2 hours long. You have a playlist of, you know, your 4-star and 5-star songs. Well, before you go to sleep at night, you can download them to your device. Just click one button. You don't have to download each individual song. You click one button for your playlist at the bottom and it says download all the songs. And if there's 300 songs or 20 songs or 700 songs, whatever, they'll download all of those to your device. So it's now local. And you can always erase them from your device. It just doesn't matter. So that's what it takes, a little bit of planning. But I think in the days of smaller iPods and stuff, we did that anyway. I don't know about you. I did.
Oh, I know. I had to. Yes.
What would be perfect if everything was instant and everywhere? Well, everything is everywhere now, but it is an instant.
Well, and I guess we should point out the fact that the last time we spoke, I think, was in 2009 when you were on the show to discuss the Beatles box sets that were being released. Oh. And at the time, you had, I guess you couldn't see your desk because there were so many CDs coming your way, because as somebody who produces music for NPR and produces music show, you're reviewing all of these albums. And so every publicist, every label publicist is sending you records to review, and artists are sending you likewise the, you know, records and albums to review in hopes that you'll play it. Now, are those publicists, are you still receiving physical media, or is it all done online at this point?
It's shifting. This is like for the media, probably it's 2003, which is meaning that I'm still getting, back in those days, I'd still be getting, listening to the majority of my music on CD, but more and more was coming online. Well, to confuse the issue less, I'd say I'm getting 70% of my music still on CD, 30% from the cloud. Or I shouldn't say the cloud, that's confusing. From downloadable files from publicists.
But I find those downloadable files are a huge pain. A lot of the times they're not tagged properly. You have to, or they don't have the track order, or they don't have all the information on them. So I get files from publicists, and then I have to spend 20 minutes tagging it, arranging it, putting the songs in order, saying this is track 1 out of 27, track 2. It's a
right.
Huge...
I've been telling all my publicists, look, just give me MP3 or AAC files of everything. Forget the WAV files; they don't work. You know, when they translate, because they don't have any metadata, which means they don't have the track number, or they often don't have the song title right. Or they don't have the album art. Just rip the record as you would if you were in iTunes, and then just drag it over into a folder and give me that folder.
Well, do you think that part of the reason that labels and artists still send you CDs and want to send you WAV files is because of the quality? CD is a bit, you know, higher quality than even a 320 kilobit per second MP3 or an AAC. And a WAV file is CD quality. Do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going down we're diverging somewhere, but down a road we don't necessarily need to get to. But for my purposes, a 256 AAC serves almost every purpose. I listen to all my music over my stereo that way. Listen to all my music in my car that way. It is a perfect sweet spot for the marries convenience and quality. Is it better than a WAV? Well, of course not. Is it going to work almost as well? Of course it is. So that's a sweet spot.
On the iTunes Match service, you get that sweet spot of the 256 kilobyte per second, and it costs about $25 a year, and you have a 25,000 song limit. I'm a little surprised that you haven't. Didn't you go over that limit of 25,000?
Yeah, that's my nightmare right now.
So how much extra does it cost you a year or a month with all the music? Or some people said if you want to, you can segregate and pick 25,000.
I can't pay my way through it. There's 25,000 song limit. I don't care if you have two songs or you have 25,000 songs or you have 40,000 songs. There's a $25,000 song limit, and you can't pay your way out of it. So there are tricks I have to do to make it so that I can have my 25,000 songs, and the ones I don't care about, I kind of hide. This may be getting a little inside, but I don't know your audience well enough to know whether they care about this stuff. But if there's a bunch of songs that I have, like two-star songs that I don't care if I ever have access to, but I don't want to delete them, I just select the song, change the media kind to like voice memo, and then iTunes Match ignores them, but it's still in my iTunes library. So that's my little trick for getting. But it's not, I'm not happy about this 25,000 song limit, but that's my way currently around it. It is an issue. Here's another issue. The 256 while I'm driving is almost unnecessary, and bandwidth wise, I have the unlimited, you know, plan from buying the iPhone the very first day it came out. And from that unlimited plan, if you had AT&T, you know that that plan really isn't very unlimited. Have you talked about this on your show?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we could all get started on this, but I'm in the secret, very privileged. You are now the top, 4% users. We're about to throttle you. And of course, I'm about to throttle them because they're trying to throttle me. It says unlimited plan, but at 3 gigs, they slow you down. So when I drive my 20, 25 minute drive to work and 20, 25 minutes back, and I listen to 256, and I do that for 30 days, by about 20 days into the plan, I start hitting that and getting those messages from AT&T. So I'm hoping that iTunes Match actually will let you do a 128 stream of your music if you want to choose to do that. That would really be a big plus, because Spotify does, I'm guessing from the sound of it, 128s, and they sound pretty good when I'm driving around. I wouldn't want it on my home stereo, but I'd be happy with it driving around.
Well, let me ask you about Spotify for a second, because we're talking about streaming music and we're talking about music storage, but Spotify is streaming only. I know that they kind of go into your iTunes library and tell you what you have, but for the most part, it's every song, most songs, millions and millions of songs that you can listen to and take with you. At least if you are a paying subscriber, you can take them with you. And so you're using Spotify, but there seems like 1,000 other services out there. Is there a service that you recommend these days?
I think, if I were 15 years old and didn't have a collection, Spotify, and I'd even pay the $10 to go mobile. Spotify, for those who don't know, is, as you say, almost every an awful lot of music. It is free if you use it only on your computer, and you can listen to an awful lot of things, and it looks at your iTunes library and matches your playlists and does all sorts of things. I think they're closer to the future than anybody out there. If you want to go mobile with Spotify, well, then you pay. And right. $10 a month to have that kind of access, if I was younger and didn't have a collection, I'd go there. I mean, it's very interesting. I think they're the closest people to giving iTunes a run for their money in terms of like, what is the future of the next music interface? They're closest. They have they don't have ping. But I mean, they really do have a good social. When I listen to a song on Spotify, if I don't remember, all of my friends will know I listen to it on Spotify. And that is a plus for a good generation of people.
Well, do you think that's actually changing the way people certainly maybe the way people discover music, but the way we listen to music? I know that during the 2000s, from like 2003 to 2011, even today, music blogs were just, the way you discovered new music. And then there were podcasts, obviously All Songs Considered being the bellwether there of what music we were going to be listening to tomorrow. Now it seems like, blogs may not be as important. Is that the case now that Spotify and RDO and Rhapsody and all of these services are out there?
I think, or maybe I just like to think this is my job, but I think that we always want some sort of other voice to help us. It's not the 100% voice. Like when I was a kid growing up, the voice I heard on the radio was the way I found my music. And it wasn't, and maybe my friends, but we all heard it through the same shows we were listening to on the radio. Second stage was friends plus trusted voice. Third is, you know, now, like you say, blogs, lots of trusted voices and friends. I don't think trusted voices is going away. I do think that, you know, friends are becoming a bigger, bigger thing because we're all hearing different sorts of trusted voices. When I say that, I mean a blog or whatever. And so we're able to say, we don't have to say, I happen to hear a song on, you name the blog, but you will see it as a friend of mine on Facebook that I listen to that song, and you'd go click it. So in that way, it just sort of trickles down. I think it's great.
Well, one thing that you mentioned in your piece, which is a big issue I have as well that isn't talked about a lot, are liner notes and song listings and lyrics.
Yeah.
With digital music, you just don't see the liner notes. You don't see song listings. I find for the last few years, I have a lot more trouble remembering the names of the songs and the artists I'm talking about because I'm listening to them.
Oh, I thought that was age.
Yeah, I thought it was too, but I realized I'm not sitting there holding the CD looking at that, you know, track listing or looking at the liner notes, looking at the lyrics while I'm listening to a song. I think part of the reason, along with my onset of Alzheimer's, why I'm having trouble with that. But it is very frustrating not be able to get the lyric sheets and the liner notes with albums anymore. That's something that you brought up that is one of the downsides to the digital age.
Yeah, and even you know, I think iTunes needs a major redesign, and certainly the player on my phone, and even I think any of the Android players, and even Spotify. I want to see the title when I'm on a mobile device. Big, I want to see.
Yeah,
I don't want to squint. I don't want to look. My phone might be a hand's distance away from me. I want to see I want to see it big. I want to see the artwork. You know, today I was listening to, we're about to do a show, Best Music of the Year so far. I really love the Regina Spektor record. I'm listening to it on my iTunes. And I think, God, who produced this? I don't even remember. Was it Mike Elizondo? Let me look. And I realized I had to leave iTunes to go find out. You know, it wasn't part of the metadata. Why? There's no reason that stuff shouldn't be part of the metadata. It's crazy. It's weird. It's
wrong.
I don't understand why people haven't kicked up a fuss about it. I know that people don't, as I did, because life was different, had less distractions. People don't just sit and listen to an album from beginning to end without distraction. In fact, the other day I had a conversation with a number of people as part of a listening party, All Songs Considered did. And I said, how many people listen undistracted? And almost everybody raised their hand. I was really surprised. And I said, well, are you... And then one person said, yeah, while driving, right? And another person said, yeah, while I'm on the computer, you know? So the idea that what undistracted is really different than it used to be. But I'd still like to be looking at some artwork, and I still want to be looking at song titles and who's playing who's doing that bass guitar.
So what's the best thing about being in the cloud and what's the worst thing? Is the best thing just, have you found yourself somewhere else where you suddenly decided you wanted to hear a song or an album and you could? Has that happened to you in the last?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it happens all the time. And I'm really grateful for that part of the cloud. The downside is you're really dependent on connectivity. And so driving, New York City and Washington and the main cities I've now tried this in, both as a walking person and a driving person. And it's amazing how much further cell networks have to be to make this really the future. This is a hint at the future. It really is available to work now, but it doesn't work without hiccups and hesitation. And that's the downside.
Well, if you think about it, in what, 1912... I mean, we were just beginning to deal with, you know, Edison's sound recordings. Oh, that's actually, you know, we were a little bit further beyond that. But I mean, we were just dealing with you know, records. This recorded music and recorded sound was a fairly new technology. So if you think about 2012, you know, by the time we hit 2020 and 2030, you know, who knows what the future, I mean, the technology can move pretty quickly, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. I think if I was out there, I'd say, why should I do this? You know, if I were sitting out there listening and wondering, should I delete all my music like some people are doing, like Bob did or whatever? I'd say the first thing to do if you have is to try, you can do a 30-day Spotify trial, you know, to get the mobile. That's one way. Just see how you like going around with the music in the cloud. You can try iTunes Match. It's $25 a year. Totally worth it if you're an iTunes person. Tell me, does it work in on an Android? I'm ignorant.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, so let's say you have an iPhone, iPad. For $25 a year, you win no matter what, because all of that music at 128, and I don't know if you want me to explain how you do this, but you can now get higher bitrate versions of it. If you don't like it, you still get those higher bitrate versions, and they're still downloadable, and they can be on your computer. So it feels like a no-brainer, $25. But you can turn on iTunes. You don't have to do much of anything. You turn on iTunes Match on your phone and just start driving and see what your city's like, see what your connectivity is like with the service you have. I might do better with Verizon, but I don't have Verizon, so I don't know. But I know it's a little buggy, but still worth trying, because I do think this is where we're heading.
Well, do you think that services like Spotify and like iTunes Match, is it changing the world of independent music? Because I know that's, you know, it's something that you're very close to, obviously, but I mean, it seemed like there was a golden age for independent music over the past 5 to 7 years or 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And is it changing the artists at all, or which artists are, or how many artists are out there?
I'm not sure that it'll do that. I don't know that it'll have that effect. But the scary part that I am worried about is, for example, the reason I'm hesitant about Spotify is for a lot of people, the way they do pay, and this is a bigger reporter piece than I'm going to be able to do here, but a lot of anecdotal stories of people I talk to will tell me, oh, my artist got $200,000 plays on Spotify and got paid.
And they got 10 cents.
I got paid $400. That's the story I heard, and I believe that story. I'm not going to, I wouldn't say that on All Things Considered as a radio piece unless I did a little more investigation and try to sort it out. But anecdotally, I hear these stories over and over again that artists get paid really puny amounts of money because it may be 10 cents, but it filters down depending on who you're doing. So they may be paying the record label, Columbia might get the 10 cents, but then where's that 10 cents go? And so by the time it trickles to artist, it's less. And so that concerns me from a, small label perspective, small artist perspective. And it's really something I want to investigate more. I'm not up in arms about it, but it's something I'm concerned about. And I don't know how iTunes Match and iTunes is equally paying people, not paying people. But I worry about those models and want to make sure if we want independent music to work, people have to get paid for what they do. And it's certainly better than the days where everybody stole the music.
That's right? True.
I mean, so in that way, it seems like it's going to be better.
Well, that's the whole story of analog dollars into digital dimes, that whole argument.
Tell me more. I've never heard that expression. I like it.
It's Jeff Zucker, who was the head of Universal and NBC, I should say, NBC Universal. He was arguing about all of these digital deals that he was being forced to do, and he really felt like he was taking these analog dollars that he would get for syndicating a television show and giving them to Hulu for dimes. So he thought, great, now it's all digital, but I'm not getting paid nearly as much as when I could broadcast these shows or when I could release them on DVD or put them in a movie theater. Now I'm just getting a fraction of what I used to get for the same product.
Interesting. I would think that the world, I don't know because I haven't done investigating, but I would think that the world of people is so much bigger. That granted, they're dimes, but you would think that there's so many more markets for this now.
I have to ask one final question.
Yeah.
You say you have about 76 days of music on your iTunes. I'm not sure how many tracks you have. 76 days of listening. Your iTunes will tell you how long. Why so little?
What? 76 days?
No, I'm serious. I am dwarfed by a lot of people and their music collections.
When I first started ripping stuff in iTunes, I would rip one song. That was my choice. I'd rip one song from every CD.
Okay, so that's okay, because let's face it, if there's anybody on this planet that is getting more music than anybody else, you are probably at the top
I'm
of that list.
A lot, right? And I also clean constantly. And the main reason to do that is just, again, I mean, I had a 500 gig hard drive, which I thought was huge. 230 of it was music. And and my computer was just running slow because it was always needing more. I'm, you know, doing video editing and stuff on it, and it's like, help me, help me. And it was getting very frustrating. So I'm used to kind of combing through my library and say, I'm never going to listen to this, or the CD's on my wall. If I want to listen to it, I'll just rip it in when I need it. So we all have different approaches to what we think of in our digital collection. If I'm listening to, let's say I'm listening to, you know, old Kinks record, I say, oh man, I only rip one song. I'd really love to hear the whole thing. Well, just go on my wall and rip it. It's not like it's never going to be there. So I had to start somewhere. And back in the days of my first laptops, I don't know about yours, but my first laptops were 60 gig drives, were huge.
60 gigs. My first laptop was a 2 gigabyte hard drive.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, I'm just thinking of the last 5 years, you know, of laptops where I really started ripping more heavily and heavily my CDs.
And you say you have 2,500 CDs. You must call a lot. You must be very disciplined about the music that you get in and what you keep and what you get rid of.
Yeah, but also remember this. Remember, what I take home, and that's what I'm counting when I say that number, has nothing to do with here at NPR. Right?
Oh, okay.
That's a whole different... I don't count that as mine, even though I can walk right up to that wall and do what I want. They were sent to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not even counting that stuff.
Okay, okay. So that makes sense. A lot of music you keep at your work location. Yeah.
And if you actually want to see that wall of CDs, you can see that wall on the podcast for Tiny Desk Concerts, which is one of the shows you produce where...
Oh, I'm going to tell you a secret about that wall. That wall is only CDs I've never listened to.
Oh, my God.
That's not the wall of CDs that we've put on our show and we've archived. That's just the influx. You could see how much, and whether I'm caught up or not, by looking behind that wall of those musicians.
So basically, if the wall starts dwindling down, then you're catching up.
I'm catching up, right? When you see them, say, looking at the A's, the upper left-hand corner, if it's the furthest ones to the right are the newest ones. So if you see that A's full, it means it's probably about 6 weeks of stuff I've not gone through, just in the A's, just the letter A.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, now you said you're doing a show that's the best of the year so far. That is one of the best podcasts of the year, along with, of course, the final episode of All Songs Considered, which can be found on the NPR website, also on iTunes, of course. The final show is the best songs of the year and the best albums of the year. I certainly look forward to hearing what you think is good so far. And are you going to Newport again this year?
Yes, I'll be at Newport.
Well, certainly, again, you really do have to check out All Songs Considered. It is, like I said, one of the best shows and one of the best podcasts online today. Is there anything else we should be plugging, Bob?
Let's see. The Tiny Desk Concerts, you mentioned, they're video podcasts of two. We usually put two a week out, one on Monday, one on Thursday. Bands play at my desk, which sounds like a kind of a silly idea. And it really is a series I'm really proud of because you get really interesting, unusual performances from artists you may or may not know. So you may find artists you love doing something unusual, or you may get turned on to, you know, some... anything from a jazz harpist from Colombia to, you know, Phoenix, the band Phoenix. You just never know. So that's a series I really love.
NPR.org/music. Definitely check it out. And Bob, thank you for taking the time to speak with us about how you have decided to, as a music person, delete all of your music.
Thanks. Thanks. You take care. Thanks for asking. Nice.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'm looking forward to catching his new podcast because I love a half-year checkup on what albums I should be listening to. I have the Regina Spektor. I like it a lot, and there are some other albums I love, and I'm looking forward to finding out what he's been listening to.
No, I'll tell you, it really, if you have like just a couple podcasts to listen to, of course, Showbiz Sandbox and This Week in Tech, but certainly All Songs Considered is one of the best podcasts out there. It is telling you what you will be listening to in a month or two. Bob Boylan and his crew always have it early.
I wonder if he's going to have dance music on his best of the year list so far.
You know, I wouldn't actually be shocked if Bob Boylan and Robin Hilden and all of those, you know, he's got a whole crew there that puts All Songs Considered together. I wouldn't be shocked if dance music is a part of it because it really is taking off. I mean, for me, it seems like so 2000, 2001, 2002. But I guess it really, you know, with Skrillex and Tiesto and Dave Guetta, all of these new acts becoming headliners, I guess dance music is the next big thing in music, even though for some of us, it's yesterday's news. So much so that Robert Silliman, who you may know as Bob Silliman, and you may know because he was the person who put Live Nation together. He was the executive that in the 90s said, well, what if we take all of these regional concert promoters, roll them up, basically go around as Clear Channel and start buying them one by one and putting them into one giant corporation called Clear Channel. So big, in fact, that we're going to have to change our name because people won't like us. And then basically sell the company. And that's exactly what he did with SFX Entertainment in the 90s and Clear Channel. And he's doing it again, but this time with these big dance music promoters.
So instead of rock promoters or people who promote concerts, he's getting people who are promoting raves.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, basically the folks that would, you know, whether in Los Angeles, it would be Giant would be one of the well, formerly Giant, one of the big promoters. You know, the people who put these shows on at these nightclubs that last until 3 or 4 in the morning on a regular basis, this is who he's buying up. And right now, he bought up this disco production to Louisiana company that was, you know, founded by a rave promoter, Donnie Estopenal. I can't pronounce his name properly. But now he's got like 50 other companies, 50 other rave promoters that he's trying to enter into agreements with, and already has tentative agreements with about 15 of them.
Well, you know, scale helps. So if you have that scale and you can bring those tours or bring those acts and bring those events around the country, one always wonders about integrity or coolness, whether the fans of this stuff want it to be more organic and natural. But you know what? When you've got Earth organic type festivals happening all over the country, and those people are going to big branded festivals, I don't see why it shouldn't work with dance music.
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is exactly, I mean, he was kind of, Bob Silliman was faulted in the 90s for rolling up all of these local promoters into Clear Channel.
And not by his stockholders.
Exactly. And, you know, he said, no, I wasn't doing it with an exit strategy. I was just doing it to increase the value to my shareholders. Well,
it's just easier to make these things work.
Right. And in this case, he has no stockholders. And instead, he's going to spend about $1 billion on acquisitions over the next year. And he wants to take the company public this summer. So he can't use the same excuse. Oh, my shareholders want that. No, you're creating the shareholders. So so he's really doing this as you know, he's 64 years old. He's probably this is his. Not to say he's not wealthy already.
I wouldn't say it's a swan song.
No.
People in their 70s and 80s doing stuff.
Yeah. No, he's cashing out. I mean, he's basically wants to figure out a way to make another bundle of money.
I don't think he's cashing out. He's creating another big business.
True, yeah.
Cashing out is something you do after you've accomplished it. And it is a big business. You look at the Electric Daisy Carnival. That's a sort of a dance promotional type event, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it started here in Los Angeles. It had to move after the whole... You know, it was at the L.A. Coliseum, and there was a whole scandal about how it got to be at the L.A. Coliseum. I'm not going to go into that. It's not worth it. So they moved to Las Vegas, and I guess at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway over the weekend, there were some high winds on Saturday night, the second night of the festival, and there were 90,000 attendees showed up at this festival. And they were on the field, and the promoters had to say, you know what, guys, we're going to have to move you back off the field and into the stands because these high winds, as a safety precaution, we don't want anybody on the field close to these temporary stages and structures because they could fall over.
Well, we had those country festivals where the stage collapsed and some people were injured or killed. So, I mean, it's been happening. So, they got to take safety precautions.
That's right. I mean, so by 1 in the morning, what I love is, at 1 in the morning, they told them, okay, everybody off the field and into the stands. And then at 2:45, they decided, you know what, we're going to keep you there so you can't come back onto the field, which kind of ruins the whole aura of an electronic dance music concert, when you have like the DJ sitting in the middle of an empty field and everybody's in the stands.
That's a bummer, but if you're on Ecstasy, maybe you didn't notice.
That's true. Well, the show went until 5:30 in the morning.
There you go.
And you probably didn't notice that you were up so late either if you were on Ecstasy.
Yeah, when the elements take control, there's not much you can do.
But now let me ask you something, because dance music really has, I mean, when I was listening to it in the early 2000s, you know, it was never really charting that much. I mean, you'd have, you know, the odd song in a movie or commercial kind of make big noise, but you didn't have, you know, number one singles as as electronica, you know.
Well, it's more of an event and an experience than acts putting together songs. You know, when you talk about DJs and raves, it's not about them creating new music as it is creating an aura and an event.
Right. So unless maybe what if they change the way...
There were certainly DJs charting over like Moby and people like that.
Exactly. But what if they changed the way the charts worked and included...
It wasn't that music sales weren't being charted. It's that the experience was more the rave rather than the album that you would buy by a DJ. It was more about going to the event. It was a live event rather than an album that you were enjoying. So it wasn't that the dance music that was being done at raves was being ignored. It's that it was the event and the live feel. It's like going to a Dead concert. You know, the Dead concerts don't chart. It's a concert.
Okay, well, I was just trying to segue into this story about how the book publishing industry.
That's right.
Yeah, anyway.
Because you were hinting that the music industry was upended when SoundScan began. It used to be that they estimated what albums were selling well. When they wanted to come up with the charts each week, somebody would call up Tower Records in each town and say, hey, what are your top 10 albums? And they'd say, oh, number one, I think, is Bruce Springsteen. Number two is The Who. Number three is Rolling Stone. You know, they would just sort of guess what the top 10 songs were or the top 10 albums. And also, they get paid off by the record labels. The record labels would say, hey, we're pushing this new act. Put them on your list, even if they didn't have the sales. And they'd say, here's $1,000 and a line of Coke. And so the people would put those people on their list.
I don't know what soft drinks have to do with music at all. But anyway.
So those lists had nothing to do, really, with what was actually selling. And what happened was they switched to charts for Billboard that reflected actual sales at the counter. So when you bought an album, bing, that sale was registered and became part of the actual sales list. No more estimates, literally sales of what was being sold in the store. And what happened? Suddenly on the charts, you found country music in the top 10, gospel music, rap. It completely upended people's ideas of what was popular, what was being sold. And when you had country albums on the top 10 chart, suddenly the New York Times and Time Magazine and all these newspapers and magazines said, hey, maybe we should do stories on these acts. They seem to be pretty popular. That's a big reason why Garth Brooks was so big, because his sales were reflected, and now it steamrolls. You get more attention, you get more sales, and that's why the charts were so galvanized by the introduction of SoundScan. But now, the same thing is going to happen in the bookstore.
I was going to say, we're talking about books.
That's right. That's what happened in music. When you switch from estimates or from what the labels wanted you to be told you were listening to, when you switch to actual sales, it was a huge revolution. The same could be happening in the book industry. They've switched to BookScan. It's the book version of SoundScan. Instead of estimates or rankings and people reporting what's been sold, they're tracking actual sales. BookScan captures print sales in about 80% of the country, 80% of the markets. So they're missing some sales outlets, probably like Costco and things like that. But they are capturing about 80% of print sales. The book scan does not include digital sales for the simple reason that most of those go through Amazon and Amazon ain't sharing.
That's a huge problem, don't you think?
That is a huge problem down the road. Amazon doesn't want to share what its sales records are. That is a big problem. And they obviously have to include digital down the road. I'm sure they're working with Nook and Amazon to try and include them in the chart. But right now, they haven't been including digital sales in their charts, so they've been only including print, but it's been an estimate. So now they're going to be a lot more accurate. So now the new charts introduced this week reflect
This has been a long complaint of yours that, you know, you can't actually get the number of units sold each week. That, you know,
right. In the UK, they've had this for years. You look at the book charts and it would say, hey, the number one book in the country is this in hardcover, and it sold 32,474 copies. And I was like, oh my God, that's awesome. And it would also list how much it had sold overall, period. In the U.S., you at the end of the year, you'd get like rough estimates from the publishers about this book had sold 800,000 and these books sold 700,000. But it was only once a year at the end. Now we're getting running tallies. So now they have a new chart. We've got it in our show notes. We've listed the top 30 and a link to the chart, which is the top 100 books in any category, any genre, any format. And this is another big thing. The New York Times bestseller list doesn't include children's books because Harry Potter was so popular. They said, oh my God, we can't have our charts clogged up with Harry Potter books. So they said, we're never going to list children's books on our charts again, which is like saying, here's the top 10 movies of the week, but we'll ignore animated films.
Right.
You know, it makes no sense whatsoever. So now, for the first time ever, we've got a chart that reflects at least a chunk of book sales. It's actual sales in every format, every genre, paperback, hardcover, it doesn't matter. So if you look at this chart, you'll see the most popular books in the country. As you might know, it's erotica, 50 Shades of Grey. These books have sold this week 363,000 copies for book one, 229,000 copies for book two and 191,000 copies in book three. And that doesn't include digital. So believe me, these numbers are a lot bigger in digital. But that's 700,000, 800,000 copies in paperback. That's a lot of paperbacks in 1 week.
Well, and I always thought that folks in the publishing industry were a little bit more, I don't know, I guess, sophisticated, so to speak, or a little bit more
educated.
Oh, no,
they're very old-fashioned. They would do contracts with, you know, feather quills if they could. I mean, they're very, very slow to change, slow to adapt to new things. I am getting a lot of galleys in ebooks, but they're pretty slow to change. So,
no, what I mean is, you know, SoundScan is the music tracking service.
Yeah.
They couldn't come up with a better title than BookScan. They had to copy what the music industry is doing.
Well, it's the same company.
I know, but still.
No, it makes perfect sense.
Oh.
So the top three bestsellers are 50 Shades of Grey, but then you can buy them in a bundled box, and that also has a place on the charts. The next three charts, the next three books on the list are the Hunger Games books. You know, you've got the Hunger Games in hardcover and paperback, and you've got a box set of Hunger Games. So they have like five or six slots on this chart. So you have to add them all up if you want to figure out what the Hunger Games books have done in all formats and all possibilities and way of buying them. And it doesn't include digital, but it is a lot better. And the big exciting thing here is if you look at this list, you've got in the top 10, you've got Oh, the Places You'll Go, which used to appear on the New York Times bestseller list every year around graduation time. It's the Dr. Seuss book, a big popular, you know, graduation gift. Here it is back on the charts like it should appear every year because it's a very popular book to give away to kids graduating. You used to see it on the charts every year on the New York Times. That would make people go, oh, yeah, that's a great gift to give for graduation. And that would encourage more sales. But since it disappeared from the New York Times, you know, people might forget about it. But it is still a popular gift. At number 10 is a romance novel, a paperback from Harlequin. Linda Lale Miller is a woman I just become aware of about a week ago. Her new book, a paperback original called Big Sky Country. She's like the queen of the Western romance. All her books are set in the West, the U.S. West. Not always period, sometimes contemporary.
So instead of ripping bodices, we have ripping chaps? Is that?
Exactly.
Okay.
But, you know, this is a woman I just become aware of. She's a very popular romance author, but most of us have never heard of her because her books were not being seen on the top chart. But now here she is at number 10 with this paperback release. It sold 22,000 copies this week. It just came out. And someone who maybe got very little attention now could become a name brand author like, you know, Nora Roberts, who is probably the best-selling romance novelist
right now.
Jackie Collins, and all those people. Right, exactly. And this is what matters. And then books that are being sold and are getting commercial sales are not always visible, and so they don't break out to a wider audience. Children's books, romance novels, if you keep looking down, you'll find a religious book. At number 20 is Jesus Calling, Enjoying Peace in His Presence, a special and revised edition by Sarah Young. That comes from a religious publisher. I've never heard of it. It's a seven-year-old book, but it sold 13,000 copies last week. That's a lot of copies. It sold 300,000 copies overall. So now when these books appear on the chart, they get a chance to get attention and media coverage, and people will notice them and hear about them and have a chance to maybe check them out.
Was this the same book that they were singing about at the beginning of the Tony Awards? Because that was a religious book they were singing about too.
That
right?
was the Book of Mormon, which
I'm sorry.
Which did not make the charts this week, probably because it's given away.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm very excited about the chart. Check it out. I think it's going to radicalize coverage of books and the books that get covered, more romance authors, more genre books, more religious books, more diversity, and an actual reflection of book sales. We're getting total numbers tabulated, you know, to date, which is very exciting. And down the road, I'm sure they'll be including digital sales. So it'll become a really accurate, really good representation of what people are actually buying. And it's a very exciting change. I think a year, two, 3 years down the road, we're going to see how significant this really was.
So it's kind of a big deal then.
It's very much a big deal.
All right. Okay, then. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, General Motors is playing chicken with the major networks. The car company is refusing to buy any ads during the upfront market and insists the major networks must drop their rates by, you know, up to 20%, rashly assuming that network shows with fewer viewers should in fact get, I don't know, less money for their ads. The networks are holding tight, and so far no one is budging. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, I'm afraid, for GM, because they've tried this before. People have done it in the 70s where they tried to say, you know, hold tight and say, no, we're not going to pay these big dollars. We're going to wait. And then they end up having to wait for the scatter market where they have to buy individual ads down the road, and those tend to be more expensive because most of the sales have already been made. And so there's not a lot of, you know, value left. There's not a lot of slots left in network television. What's happening right here, all the networks are up, usually in single digits in sales, but all of them are up except for NBC, which is, you know, very much in the trough. And GM has not budged yet, but guess what? Everybody's making sales and they've increased their rates. So GM is not going to win this battle.
Glenn Beck may be off the Fox News channels, but he's still a force both online and on the radio. The Wall Street Journal reports that Beck's online website / university should generate some $40 million in revenue this year. And now Beck has signed a new contract with Clear Channel. The 5-year deal is worth $100 million. Though Beck doesn't have a presence on TV, he's managed to nearly double the take from his last contract. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I'm not quite sure why it happened. He's the third biggest radio voice right behind Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, the other two big voices in talk radio.
What about Howard Stern?
He's satellite radio.
Okay.
So that's a slightly different world. The measurement of his audience is a little trickier.
Don
Imus is a little bit lower. You know, he's faded a little bit. You know, he's not as prominent as he used to be. Those are the top three in talk radio. You know, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck. He's doubled his contract, which is kind of amazing since he doesn't have that visibility and platform of Fox News anymore. But hey, you know, if he's pulling in the ratings, I guess that's where the money is.
Microsoft heralded the launch of a new music service it dubbed Xbox Music. This isn't just a rebranding to take advantage of the Xbox name. The current Microsoft music service, Zune, is falling by the wayside. Xbox Music launches in the fall. No word on how soon the fans of Zune will be left out in the cold or any grandfathering they will get for the new service. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal if you're in Zune, and it's a big whoop if you're not.
That's true. Hey, is Modern Family bigger than American Idol? In the key 18 to 49 demographic, yes, it is. It takes a while for DVR stats to trickle in, but it looks like in late May, as the season finales approached, that Modern Family outgunned American Idol in the viewers advertisers really care about the most. According to the New York Times, Modern Family added 4.3 million viewers to its live total once you added in viewership of DVR for the following week, also known as Live Plus 7. Advertisers now pay for Live Plus 3 ratings, but these numbers still matter. Modern Family also saw a massive 59% increase in the 18 to 49 demo and beat Idol. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, the more you reflect how much people are actually watching TV shows, just like we talked about with book sales, when you see what they're actually watching, that should matter, and that makes a change and a difference. You can see how the rankings change and move. It was a very short little blurb, and it didn't put it in context. It didn't tell us what the numbers were in the 18 to 49 demo. It didn't say where they were for the season, because as we know, Modern Family and The Big Bang Theory are tied in that demo. So does that mean Big Bang Theory for the season also beat American Idol? So I found the story unsatisfying. It was just a quick blurb. But yes, DVR usage matters.
The hosts of the wildly popular NPR radio show Car Talk are hanging up their tools and calling it a day.
But my muffler is acting up.
Well, if I had a Boston accent, I could tell you how to fix it. After 35 years, the show that fielded questions about car repairs, known more for its comedy than its nuts and bolts, though there was plenty of that too, it's ending all of its new episodes. Hosted by two brothers, the show is one of NPR's biggest hits. But they're getting on in years. One turned 75 this year and decided it was time to stop and smell the cappuccino. That doesn't mean the end of the show, however. Like the Peanuts comic strip, Car Talk isn't going anywhere. NPR simply plans to edit old shows and do classic repeats and keep the series running for the foreseeable future. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for fans of the show. It is a massively popular show. I guess if you have questions about your electric car, that won't be the place to turn to anymore, since they'll only be dealing with, you know, mechanical old cars. I love this quote, though. One of the people who was in charge of Southern California Public Radio said, you know, depending on these reruns, quote, underscores how important it is for public radio specifically and public media generally to be developing new shows, because these guys aren't going to live forever, and neither is Garrison Keillor. Ouch! neither is Bill Moyers, I might point out.
I thought that was a great quote, and it's funny that I read the article and you pulled that quote, because I read that and I was like, interesting quote.
If only we could think of a really good show that would work on national public radio that would be entertaining and formative and fresh.
I have no idea. I mean, certainly. Wait a second.
Somebody call Bill Davis.
Exactly. In a story truly only tech geeks could love, which is why we're bringing it up here, Netflix is moving away from the commercial companies that make money off of hosting online content. You know, companies like, Amazon. They're called content delivery.
Amazon?
Yeah, that's where.
Amazon provides content delivery networks?
Oh, are you kidding me? Yes, they're one of the largest ones in the world.
Oh, okay.
They're called CDNs, content delivery networks. They serve as middlemen to get content from providers like Netflix to users on individual ISPs such as Time Warner or Comcast. A very small number of websites are so big and have so much traffic that they host their own content and provide it directly to ISPs. People like, you know, YouTube is probably the most prominent example. Now that Netflix's growth and library is so enormous, they've decided to do the exact same thing. This means that commercial CDNs owned by the likes of Comcast, AT&T, Rackspace, Amazon, they will lose a nice paycheck from Netflix. And that Netflix has been paying to handle all of their data. They've been writing Time Warner and Comcast checks for the last 8 years now, 6 years.
Is that their main one, or do they use a bunch of them?
They use a whole bunch of them.
Okay.
But, well, their main one actually was Amazon.
Oh.
But if they're ISPs, they might save money on the back end by letting Netflix shoulder more of the digital burden. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm not even sure. What's the difference to the ISPs if Netflix hosts its own stuff?
Well, right now, one of the big reasons...
Were the CDNs charging the end users as well? Were they charging the internet service providers?
No. They were just charging...
So they were providing it free. So they were just charging the website itself.
That's right. So basically, if you were, you know, MySpace or Google, you'd go to a CDN and say, okay, I need to host some of my content there so that when people access the content, it's a little bit closer to them. Well, the ISPs would, you know, pull it from the CDNs. And there was a big brouhaha a year ago when Level 3, which is an ISP and one of those internet backbone providers, wanted to charge Netflix more money. They wanted to charge both Netflix and Comcast more money.
Because they were using so much of their pipe.
Exactly. And so they were basically saying, wait, you're getting your... It's like when you do a wire transfer of money, they charge both the person sending the money and the person receiving it. It's like, wait, huh? I guess banks can do that, but... When it comes to internet service providers and content delivery networks and websites, somebody cried foul. And so now, you know, you have Netflix out there trying to build its own CDN.
So what's the downside for Netflix, if anything?
Well, it's going to cost them more money. They actually have to maintain their own networks.
Well, surely they would be doing it because it'll cost them less money.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think in the long run, it will cost them less money and really ultimately will provide better service to ISPs because what they can do is go to Time Warner and Comcast and say, rather than have the CDN located separately from your network, why don't we just place our CDN right in your network?
So it helps the ISPs how? On a technical level where there's less demand on their pipe for some reason?
That's right, because they're basically placing the content inside the pipe already.
Okay. I don't quite understand it, but I believe you.
So they're basically saying, hey, rather than put our water into your pipe, why don't we just put the source of the water? We'll just make the source of the water. We'll store the water in your pipe. So it's already there.
Okay.
You remember Coachella, right?
Yes.
And the big news there, well, Elvis lives. He has not left the building. His spirit has. I don't know where I'm going with this. The king of rock and roll isn't done yet, apparently. He may be dead, but that's no reason why Elvis can't be a player in the digital realm. With a hologram of Tupac Shakur performing at Coachella, estates of iconic figures realize they can do more with their artists. The Elvis estate is looking at tours with a hologram Elvis, as well as letting Presley make digital appearances in TV and film and, well, who knows, maybe your local supermarket opening. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm not sure what changed here. I thought we knew about this before, but I guess they've been signing agreements with people. Some of the companies that do this stuff like Digital Domain are stepping up their efforts to sort of use these digital likenesses and put them in actual movies and TV shows. That's different from a hologram appearing on stage for a few minutes.
Yeah, but what are their agents going to do? You know, could you imagine being the agent for Hologram Elvis, getting the call to check the availability?
Yes, I know Bill Murray made fun of this on Letterman. Like I said, that bit where he was promoting Moonrise Kingdom is pretty funny, and he had an extended thing about trumping Elvis and these digital holograms by doing his own one on the show. And I know the Frank Sinatra estate was looking at having a tour where he'd have a live orchestra, his taped vocals, and a hologram of Frank performing these songs. So we'll have to see where this heads to.
Oh, just the thought of it. I mean, it's interesting as a one-time Tupac Shakur gimmick. and it's barely interesting at that. Doing it on a regular basis,
I guess if you could get them and have them giving actual performances in new movies with new dialogue, that would be something that might be interesting. You could repurpose Humphrey Bogart, you know, 100 years from now. Maybe that makes sense.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't want to see it, but it could be interesting.
Could you just see him like playing the teacher in Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Bueller, no, I couldn't.
Bueller.
I could see Jerry Lewis, but I couldn't see Humphrey Bogart.
Bueller!
Exactly.
Joy Behar is getting current. Less than a year after leaving HLN, the popular co-host of The View is getting her own 6 p.m. show on the liberal-leaning cable channel. Since Keith Olbermann and Current angrily parted ways, the channel has added several hosts, such as California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. Needless to say, Behar is a bigger fish than that when it comes to TV. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Everybody gets to reach 80,000 viewers a night.
That's true. Hey, you know what? Sometimes it's 81,000. Don't sell them short.
Right. More power to her.
Now, speaking of huge audiences, can you believe what happened with the Justin Bieber on sale?
What was it?
Well, actually, it is our Inside Baseball story this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Apparently, last week, tickets for Justin Bieber's North American tour, that's going to be done later this year, they went on sale and they sold out in 60 minutes. Now, this was, I think, like 30 different shows sold out in 60 minutes. And people thought, how could this possibly happen? And then Billboard reported that tickets
were... Well, that doesn't seem that shocking to me.
Well, you know, it's fast, but I agree with you. It's not that shocking. What was shocking was that Billboard said the tickets for Justin Bieber's show at Madison Square Garden sold out in 30 seconds. Literally. Ouch. 30 seconds. Now, Madison Square Garden can hold 20,000 in attendance, so 20,000 fans could have gone to the show. So, and he's playing two dates, so that's 40,000, which really means that if it's sold out in 30 seconds, that's like about 1,000 tickets being sold per second.
Can the digital network handle that much traffic?
You mean like Ticketmaster or?
Yeah, yeah.
I believe they can, you know, certainly.
But it isn't. That's not exactly what happened here, is it?
No. I mean, so NPR got so suspicious about this. They went and they called Gary Bongiovanni, who is the editor or maybe the publisher of Polestar, which is the concert industry trade publication. And he said, look, you know, there's a couple reasons why this really isn't true, that there's really no such thing as a sold out concert because of all these holds and all of these marketing holdbacks. And he said a lot of those tickets, they were already sold in the days that led up to the public on sale. So American Express had a pre-sale. The fan club had a pre-sale. There were radio stations that got tickets. The record company took some tickets. And he said it wouldn't surprise me if more than half of the tickets were already accounted for before the public on sale. And then, you know, NPR went and learned that a few years back, due to all of the quote-unquote holds for a Taylor Swift show at the Summit Center in, I think it's Nashville, Tennessee. By the way, that's now known as the Bridgestone Arena, for those of you in the area. This venue holds 13,330 fans. Apparently, after all of these advanced sales, radio-sponsored pre-sales, and fan club pre-sales, only 1,591 tickets actually went on sale to the public.
And this is an old story that, you know, by the time it gets to the general public on sale date, you are already old news. I mean, it has passed you by.
Right. And now here's something that it really has only emerged over the last year or two. And that is that ticket brokers have these banks of computers. This is, by the way, the second reason that Bongiovanni pointed out as the reason that all of these tickets can go so quickly.
So, oh, yeah, because those guys are snapping up tickets with their automated machines. I mean, they try to stop them with CAPTCHA and all that stuff, but they still have automated programs that can make bids on tickets.
That's right. And so there are things called ticket drops, first of all, and there are these software pieces of software that go out and just kind of go past the CAPTCHAs. And that's where you have to enter those weird words and those numbers and before you can, just to check whether you're human. Well, these pieces of software go past that, and they are run by ticket brokers who don't snap up just one or two tickets or three or four tickets. They buy huge blocks of tickets, hundreds of tickets. And I was looking for a few tickets over the weekend, and I thought, well, you know, I can't believe I missed, you know, the Alabama Shakes at a small venue, I was really disappointed. I thought, well, how can I find out about these ticket drops that happen, usually a day or two or sometimes a few weeks before the show? And I put a little search into Google, ticket drop, Ticketmaster. And there are a dozen or more pieces of software out there that specialize in this type of activity.
Letting you know when tickets go on sale, or what is this?
No, letting you know, just automatically checking Ticketmaster, constantly pinging Ticketmaster, looking for a specific show at a specific venue on a specific date, and they will buy the tickets. But here's the thing. They can't say, oh, you wanted a seat in section 148, but no, you know, not past row 17.
Right, right. So what is available to the scalpers is available to you.
Right. They just grab, and they're not limited to 4 or 8 tickets. They're limited to however many tickets their bot can get. And so it just so happens I was at a fundraising event over the weekend and wound up speaking with the promoter for Live Nation, who is handling some of the bigger tours this summer. And he has been a concert promoter for 2 decades. And his father was a concert promoter, a very small concert promoter purchased by Clear Channel in the 90s. And so now his son works for Live Nation, which is what Clear Channel became. And he's handling the Coldplay tour and Aerosmith. And he said that Coldplay decided they were going to do 360 degrees of seating. And initially they only sold 270 degrees of seating. So basically the seats in front of the stage. And the seats behind the stage are very difficult to sell because they're not necessarily the best view. And they decided, you know what, we'll put some shows on sale at 360 degrees and see how they do. We'll sell.
You mean they were going to be obstructed view, or were they designing the stage to be in the round?
No, the obstructed view behind the, you know, basically sell tickets behind the stage.
And
so,
okay.
So they sold them in 3 cities, one of them being Miami. And this promoter, whose company now owns Ticketmaster, I might add, Ticketmaster and Live Nation are now one company, said that he was checking on how ticket sales were going. And he said at one point he saw that 2,200, like the second the tickets went on sale, 2,200 tickets were in what he calls hold, meaning that somebody through the Ticketmaster website or through the system was looking at the ticket and possibly going to buy it, and they have 3 minutes to buy it, or the ticket goes back into inventory. And he said there's no way a human being could have done that, especially when there was no public announcement of this. It was a ticket drop. Nobody knew it was happening. The second they went on sale, 2,000 tickets were kind of in this 3-minute holding pattern because all of these bots were looking for tickets to that show. Now, what he said is, in this particular case, ticket brokers got burned because they were just willing to buy any ticket for that show.
Right. They weren't being discriminatory.
Right. So they got stuck with all of these seats that were behind the stage that once they saw where, and they purchased them, they were purchased, no refunds. Once they saw where they were from, where they were seated, there was no way they could sell those tickets to fans.
Well, they could if the fans didn't know. Maybe the fans got screwed. Hey, we got a ticket to Coldplay. Here it is. You know, the fans aren't going to know it's obstructive view unless the guy tells them.
Well, no, so I mean, you
basically, I bet there are a few fans who got screwed.
I'm sure there are, but most fans would say, okay, well, where is the seat that I'm paying some ridiculous amount of money for? Is it in the front row? Mm. Is it close to the stage? Is it in front of the stage? You know, like you'd want to know where it is.
So that's a rare example of the bots biting the hand that feeds them.
Well, they often do that, but it's, you know, basically.
Well, they don't often sell tickets behind the stage at obstructed view.
No, but sometimes what winds up happening is a ticket drop occurs and it's like for some, like, you know, balcony seat way up in the back, and the bot just grabs it and gives the ticket broker this horrible seat that they can't sell.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I don't think if it's a ticket, they can sell it. You know, they put them on sale, they can sell it. I don't know. It's just it's another example of how people get screwed when they want to go to a concert. But who wants to go to a Justin Bieber concert anyway? I'm all about Austin Mahone.
Austin, I have no idea who that is, but I do know.
He's the next Justin Bieber.
Well, at this fundraising event, which was held here in my hometown, Calabasas, California, right outside of Los Angeles, sure enough, Justin Bieber bought a house in the neighborhood. And it was the talk of the fundraising event.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, really? Do we have to talk about this?
I guess your neighborhood just suddenly got cool.
Yeah, well, you know, he's living next to Britney Spears and Leanne Rimes, and yeah, so.
All right. Well, before we wind it up, you have a correction to make, don't you?
Yes, I apologize to Bruce Kirkland, who does not work for the Toronto Star. He works for the Toronto Sun. I knew it was one of those celestial beings. Like, you know, give me a break. The Sun technically is a star.
That's true.
But a couple of people wrote in that said, you know, I faulted Bruce Kirkland of the Toronto Star of getting me addicted to coffee, when indeed it was Bruce Kirkland of the Toronto Sun who got me addicted to coffee while in Cannes.
Well, thanks to those people for writing in.
Yes. And now remember, you can write in over the next 2 weeks while we are on break. We'll be possibly even retooling the show a bit. Who knows what we'll be doing over the next 2 weeks, but feel free to write to us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace for as long as it's around, or Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher, or RSS, or we can send you an email every single time we post a new episode. You know, all of those ways to contact us or to subscribe to the show, plus all of the links to the stories that we discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until 3 weeks from now, play nice.